Robert Kraft's solicitation charges are in doubt after the court throws out the videos. No word if Hoodie has had them deleted yet. I'm sure he'll get on that right away. Trump's personal Twitter account is now before the United States Supreme Court. Finally, we can get to the bottom of this kafafi. I hope I'm using that made-up word correctly. And Steve Bannon is charged with fraud over the GoFundTheWall account, which does beg the question, who donated to that cause? Isn't that like, hey, you know, I don't pay enough taxes. Why not pay more? Really, folks, if you care that little about your money, you can also send it to me. I'm building a wall around my landscaping. Well, all of this, plus I interview Steven Iverson about his book, Porcupine Principles, all in this week's Debriefing of the Law. Welcome to this week's Debriefing of the Law. I am Joel Oster, your host, and Mackenzie, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. We're doing this in the afternoon, and I think you'll see that I'm less sharp at 3:30 p.m. than I am at our usual time of like mid-morning. So the coffee because has worn off.
Well, you have a newborn, so you've probably been up now. So it's 12 hours. Who knows how long you've been up? But hey, it's good to have. Now, you should be well rested because we took a week off last week while you were vacationing. How did that go?
I did vacation. How dare I? Well, it went well. I had reserved a cabin in the Shenandoah Valley in Northern Virginia for my family and I. And I made this reservation back in early February, right before COVID, thinking that we were going to have a really busy year and the kids have a ton of activities and we'd just really need like a week away in isolation to spend quality time with each other. it was non-refundable.
Hey, you know what though? I'm assuming that the trip was fun nonetheless because you got to get out from the home. I mean, you got to go somewhere different, change the scenery. It's got to be good for you. So let me just ask you, when it comes to vacations, are you the planner or do you like to just enjoy the scenery? In other words, I like to schedule every 15 minutes of the vacation. Dang it, if I'm on a vacation, we're going to do it the right way. Or do you like to just kind of hang out and chill?
So I will have to say it depends. I've done a lot of solo traveling in my life, and I'm a huge fan of traveling solo. And when I go somewhere new, either by myself or like just with my husband, I like to be completely spontaneous and just explore. Like I'll have a couple big things that I want to hit on the vacation, but I love to go to a new city or a new place and just walk around for an entire day, see where the day takes me. But with kids, it's like a whole nother story. You cannot have, especially with a baby too, like you cannot have long stretches of unscheduled time. It devolves very quickly. It does not end well. So we were pretty scheduled. Yeah.
I am that prototypical, stereotypical guy where, yeah, if I am on vacation, I'm getting up at 6 a.m. in the morning. We're all moving. Let's get going, guys. It's like a drill sergeant. Dang, we're on vacation. We're going to get as much vacationing in as we possibly can. So, yeah, I'm lucky to be alive at the end of the vacation. My other family members have not shot me. But nonetheless, I'm glad that you are well-rested and back in the saddle. Now, when we left off, I told you that I was going to give you a little bit of homework, but I did not realize you were vacationing. So I went out and did the homework myself, which was, we're going to plan a class action lawsuit. I heard about this class action lawsuit where Subway was sued because their foot-long sub sandwich wasn't an entire 12 inches. Do you remember that?
I do. And I think I said, you know, there are other reasons why I don't want to eat at Subway, but you know, I'm game. I mean, if someone's going to write me a check, I'll cash it.
That's right. So I went to Subway and I ordered the foot long sub sandwich. And yes, I brought my tape measure with me and I measured that foot long sub sandwich. And do you know how long it was?
Tell me it was less than 12 inches.
It was 11 inches and 11 and three quarters of an inch. 11 and three quarters of an inch. So not quite a full 12 inches, but close enough, much longer than I guess. There was actually a class action lawsuit that had been filed claiming that at that point in time, they were only like 10 inches long. And Subway defended itself by saying, well, look, it was 12 when we put it in the oven, but you know, as things do, they shrink a little bit in the oven. And so, but apparently now it was pretty close to full 12 inches. So no class action lawsuit for me. I guess I got to find something else. But nonetheless.
Isn't it funny, too, how all of these crazy class action lawsuits, too, like the hot coffee, the, you know, the foot long that's only 10 inches long, or the Fruit Loops that don't taste like fruit or don't have real fruit in them or whatever. They always seek $5 million. Is that like some statute somewhere? Like to be a class action, it has to be like at least $5 million. Because every one you read about, they're like, the plaintiff is seeking $5 million. Or is that just like a nice round sum that like sounds really good to people? Like, it, I think I'm going to sue for $5 million.
I know. It reminds me of, did you ever watch that movie franchise with, I'm losing it now. Austin Powers. Have you seen Austin Powers?
Yes.
Yes. And Dr. Evil, when he came out of his hibernation, threatened, you know, blackmail or extortion, whatever, for $1 million. They had to say, that's not really that much in today's day and age.
Exactly. That's exactly what it's like.
Exactly. You can't go for $1 million. You got to go for somewhat higher than $1 million to get anyone's attention. Well, this last week has been another busy week in the world of law. And since that is our job, we debrief the law so that we can make some sense of it. There's been a lot going on. So let's start with the top headline from these last couple of weeks. Robert Kraft, owner of the New England Patriots, he was arrested for soliciting a prostitute at a massage parlor. We're going to get into the details there. Maybe not too much of the details, but we're going to get a little bit into it. But nonetheless, the videotape was thrown out by an appeals court this last week, which pretty much means the charges will go away. And Mackenzie, you and I talked about this during our planning stages, and I learned you actually have some background information as to what happened to Mr. Kraft. Go ahead and explain for our listeners, because I'm sure their imagination is running wild, but go ahead and tell me, what is the background information that you have on this case?
Yeah, so I think first of all, let me start out by saying you mispronounced the New England Deflatriates, okay? So no love lost between me and Robert Kraft, but yeah, it's not so much like an inside scoop on the case, but I feel like for a couple of the cases we're talking about today, I have some kind of weird, bizarre personal connection.
Do tell.
Yeah, alleged solicitation occurred at a day spa in Jupiter, Florida. And my parents actually live in Jupiter, Florida. And I've been going there since I can remember, really,
two to three times a year.
Yeah. So it's like my second hometown.
So where is Jupiter?
Jupiter is on the southeast coast of Florida. It's about an hour and a half north of Miami, a couple, like 20 minutes north of West Palm Beach. It's a really nice area. It's beautiful. It's idyllic, but, you know, I guess there are shady day spas, one of which happens to be, you know, this spa that's at issue in this case. It's closed now. They shut down.
It is.
Yes, but it was right next to my yoga studio, which is a little disconcerting to me. I don't want to, you know, imagine that, but it is what it is.
Right. But just so the listeners can get a picture of what we're talking about here, you've been in this particular site. This is Jupiter. This is a high-rent district, really nice houses and condominiums and things like that. I think you told me it was pretty close to West Palm Beach. Also, a lot of multi-million-dollar beachfront homes there. But this is in the same parking lot as a Publix, which is the main grocery store chain there in Florida. I used to live in Orlando, so we would shop at Publix and Albertsons all the time. But this is a nice area, right?
Oh, yeah. It's a really nice area. And Jupiter used to be, like, back in the day, it was a small little fishing town. Like, it's about 40 miles from the Bahamas. So they still send fishing, like, all the restaurants still send fishing boats out every day, daily, to fish in the Bahamas. And, so that's, like, the history of it. But now it's mostly, like, gated communities. There's a Trump property down there, Trump National Golf Course, property, like right across the street. Yeah. So there is a lower income area, but it gets smaller and smaller. I mean, it's really like a quite wealthy area. Yeah.
So what had happened was there is this Orchids Asian Day Spa there in this Publix parking lot, a strip mall, if you will, bad pun. But nonetheless, apparently some police officers kind of checked out the joint, saw a lot of guys going in there, weird looking mannerisms. And so they thought something is not going right. This is not your typical massage kind of place. And so they issued a warrant to, and they actually faked a fire or something, like the fire alarms were going off. I forget the exact details, but they faked some kind of emergency. The police officers go into this day spa and they secretly place cameras all throughout this day spa so they can videotape people and what is going on. And so Mackenzie, just right there, I want to unpack that as to lawyers and also who happen to be human beings. Does this bother you that the police go into this day spa under false pretenses and put in cameras in the ceilings so no one in the day spa knows they are being recorded in various states and stages of undress?
Well, yeah, and presumably they had a warrant to do this, and you know that it. What bothers me even more than the pretense of going in is the fact that it was completely unrestricted in scope and time, apparently. So they were, my understanding is, they were essentially recording everything for like weeks and weeks, if not months. And you know, this is a Fourth Amendment issue. Like they're. You're not allowed to subject people to unreasonable searches and seizures under the Fourth Amendment. And, you know, this seems like it was not only narrowly tailored, but it wasn't tailored at all to, you know, anything here. It just was recording totally innocent people like undressing and getting massages. And that's just not okay.
That is what bothered this appeals court. It was a 3-0 decision. And so the argument was basically made, look, the decision to go in there with a videotape camera, with this warrant, which they had, but then to record absolutely everything that took place in that spa, you know, even innocent people that would go in there for a legal massage, and there'd be videotape of them undressing fully naked. That was all caught on videotape. Even women went in there for massages, fully undressed. That was all caught on videotape. And the appeals court said, no, that's just not right. In America, you cannot do that. We do have a Fourth Amendment, which prohibits the government from doing unreasonable searches and seizures. And so here, according to the appeals court, this was unreasonable, both because of how long this was. There was no limitations as to how long they could do these recordings. And they didn't even turn them off when they knew that there was no criminal activity. So any final thoughts on this case other than I am in total agreement with you? We all hate the New England Patriots. I'm a Kansas City Chiefs fan, so I have to hate them. But nonetheless, it's good to know that you also, as a Philadelphia fan, not too fond of the New England Patriots. Any final thoughts on this case?
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's one of those situations where people, you know, when you're a lawyer, sometimes at a cocktail party or whatever, people ask you, like, would you defend someone of murder that you knew was guilty or whatever? I mean, I guess this is a case where it's kind of similar. Like, here we are, a Kansas City fan and a Philadelphia fan, like, defending Robert Kraft. It's, like, so abhorrent. However, you know, it's the Constitution. So I guess we're doing our legal duty as lawyers to, like, abide by our nation's founding document above all else. It's
See,
sad,
Mackenzie,
but true.
Mackenzie, you caught me completely off guard there. You started off by saying, look, we're lawyers and we sometimes represent things and causes that we might not agree with. Here, I thought that where you were going with that was this warrant was aimed at stopping sex trafficking, a very good objective to do. But nonetheless, as lawyers, we are going to object to the manner in which you did this valid thing because you went too far. No, that's not where you went with that story. Instead, you said representing anyone associated with the New England Patriots clearly is out of bounds. I mean, might as well represent OJ in a search for the real killer. And so, yeah, you caught me a little bit off guard there. But hey, I am a Kansas City Chiefs fan, so now that I can firmly say I'm not as bothered by the Patriots, I think their day in the sun is completely over. Well, let's move on next to President Trump's Twitter account. In this last week, the president and his legal team asked the Supreme Court to take up his case. What happened here was a lower court, the Second Circuit Court of Appeals, held that Trump's personal Twitter account was public forum. It was a public forum because Trump was using his personal Twitter account to communicate official information and things that he had done as president. And because of that, now the First Amendment strictures and guidelines would apply to his Twitter usage. And he apparently blocked two people from his Twitter account because he did not like the things that they were saying. And so the Second Circuit Court of Appeals said, you can't do that. We are going to apply some of the constitutional strictures against you in the use of your personal Twitter account. And so now the president is asking the Supreme Court to step in to somehow set the parameters. So, Mackenzie, what are your thoughts about this situation?
I mean, there's not enough coffee in the world, even at 3:30 p.m., for me to, like, fully delve into the president's use of Twitter. But I guess the first thing that comes to my mind is, like, don't most people, when they are elected to public office or become a public servant, like they deactivate their personal social media accounts. Like if you get elected to be, you know, a congressperson or whatever, you don't typically have like a personal Facebook or Instagram. It's the account associated with your role as that public official. So anything that you would do there would be under the color of the law and it would be associated with your role. I don't understand why Donald Trump still gets a personal Twitter account at all. And I think, you know, it's a fascinating area.
Now, wait
of the
a
law.
Second here. Hold on. Just because you are elected to a public office doesn't mean you cease to have a private life, does it? Now, I know what you're saying. A lot of politicians, that's what they do. Maybe out of prudence. I don't know. I'm thinking about a friend of mine who was elected as a congressman in Louisiana, and his personal account, he stopped using for the most part. And since you pointed that out, maybe that's why. But still, you should have a personal life, right? Even though you were elected as a public official. I mean,
of course. I mean, you're still entitled to have a private personal life. However, I think, you know, within the past couple of decades and couple of years, really, we've all seen, whether we're public officials or not, we've all seen a huge blurring of the line between our professional lives and our personal lives. And, you know, people get fired from their jobs all the time for stuff that they put on social media or stuff that they just happen to be doing in their personal life that someone chooses to record and then put on the internet. And we've kind of come to accept this, for better or worse, as like the way of the world these days. And I think, you know, I guess the question, it is a fascinating area of the law. And I personally believe that sooner or later, social media companies especially are going to be treated as public spaces for First Amendment purposes.
I think it's inevitable.
Yeah. I mean, especially I think COVID is even accelerating this because it's, you know, it's like the way we exclusively communicate with a lot of people is through the internet now, since we're all kind of isolated.
Yeah, the internet and these social media sites, these are the streets and sidewalks of yesteryear. And so, yeah, should you apply some of the First Amendment? So, listeners, here's what we're talking about. And this is actually a common misperception, especially in the whole football kneeling versus not kneeling Kaepernick thing. It came to light. But a lot of citizens don't really realize that the First Amendment free speech protections only applies to restrict government from interfering with your free speech. But in the private realm, like your employer would be in the private realm, they absolutely have a right to restrict your speech. You don't have the First Amendment right to free speech does not apply to your private employer. It just applies to the government. The government cannot restrict your speech. And so that is the first takeaway from this story. The second thought is, should the public officials have any, should you apply the First Amendment principles to you know, a public official's personal speech, because sometimes it is blurred. For example, let's say an elected official goes to a church service. Can that elected official preach a sermon in his private capacity? Or is he ever able to actually leave the idea that he's also a public figure? Interesting issues.
Right. And it might be a different analysis based on whether you're, you know, like a township commissioner or a member of the school board in your local school district is very different from being the president of the United States. And I think we could all agree that being the president of the United States is a much more all-encompassing role. And it's very difficult to say. I mean, obviously, like, you know, when the president is, I guess, like, with his family and doing things, you know, that are private with his family, like, of course, that should be private unless he chooses to publicize them. But other than that, when he's choosing to, however many Twitter followers he has, when he's choosing to communicate with 30, 40, 50 million people at once, like, that by definition kind of is an act as the president of the United States, even if he's not necessarily saying anything related to, like, even if he's saying kafefe, it's he's saying it as the president, regardless of what his Twitter handle is.
That underscores how important Twitter is, because without Twitter and social media, we as the American public would have no idea what kafefe actually was. Well, so the takeaway from this story is this, that this is a very significant issue, one that we all should be paying attention to. And so the Supreme Court, well, the ball is now in their court. We'll see if they pick it up and they help to clarify these legal lines. All right, also in the news this last week, I know a case that really interests you. Steve Bannon, your personal hero, was charged with a crime for defrauding the American public over the GoFundMe site where he wanted to build a wall. So I guess go fund the building of the wall between the United States and Mexico. So, Mackenzie, I know I kind of discolored you. I slandered you in just a bit, so I'm going to let you go ahead and clear your good name.
Yeah, like Steve Bannon's one of the members of the unholy trinity, the other two being Stephen Miller and Mitch McConnell, in my mind. I just think he's like the face of evil, and it doesn't surprise me at all that he was literally stealing money from unsuspecting donors. But I also want to know who
allegedly.
I stand corrected, allegedly.
That's right.
I don't know if someone asked me at a cocktail party if I could defend Steve Bannon, but I guess I would have to if called upon to do so. But I want to know also, though, who are the people, not to besmirch anyone's intelligence, but like, who are the people who are donating money to build the wall? Like, wasn't the whole thing, we're going to build a wall and Mexico has to pay for it? Like, who are the people who are now reaching into their own pockets at a time of great economic turmoil, I might add, to fund by themselves? Like, it just blows my mind that I don't think they deserve to be defrauded. I don't.
Mackenzie, that's why I like having you on this podcast. You bring out the most pressing issues, and you nailed it on the head. Who in their right mind is donating to this cause? I mean, for those of you who are donating, send your money to me. There's going to be no fraud here. I'm just going to pocket it. But nonetheless, if you don't care about your money to the extent you're actually going to give it to the funding of the building of a wall, just send it to me. I'll make good use of your money. So that is a great observation, Mackenzie. So let's actually go into the legal, what actually happened with this GoFundMe site. And so what was the charge that was alleged? So as I understand it, there was this GoFundMe page where people could donate money towards the building of this wall. And so on this site, it was said that none of the monies, 100% of the monies would go towards the building of the wall and not to pay salaries. But apparently, that might not necessarily be true. At least the allegation is that they created some shell nonprofit companies that this site then paid to these other companies who then paid salaries to these people. So they kind of found a workaround so that they could pay salaries to these people. So that is the charge that is at play. So any final thoughts on the Steve Bannon charge?
Yeah, I mean, that's my understanding as well, is that's pretty much exactly what happened. And, I guess my personal opinion is, like, a lot of times so-called white-collar fraud or white-collar crime is, like, the worst kind, because it's so calculated and it's so, you know, it's not by someone who's stealing food out of desperation. Like, this is someone who, like, irrefutably knows better, knows exactly right. what he's doing, and is taking money from clearly people who are not at the highest echelon of, like, forethought and intelligence here. So it's just, it's so reprehensible. And if true, because it is allegations, I think he should be punished to the full extent of the law.
I gotta tell you, I am going to reserve judgment, because my take on it is there is no way he could be guilty, because who could be that stupid? Well, maybe you'd be surprised sometimes how money is a temptation for people. And nonetheless, I do believe that we can cite for the record that President Trump did fire him for doing things, for engaging in inappropriate conduct. So maybe we also should set some kind of general standard that if President Trump is going to fire you for engaging in inappropriate conduct, let's just assume there's criminal activity somewhere in the midst
you
there.
Just get
because
banished
you were
at that point.
I think, yeah, come on. It's, if even Trump is firing you, go get a new line of work. Lastly here from this last week, my hero, I know you and I are going to tussle on this one in just a bit, but Lori Loughlin and her husband. By the way, don't you like, how insulted would you be to be Lori Loughlin's husband? Because he's often referred to in all these news reports as her husband. I can't even pronounce his name. Do you want to give a shot at it?
Massimo Giannulli.
Hey, you know what? That's much. I'm actually looking at it and I cannot even pronounce it. But nonetheless, he's a fashion designer. Well, Lori Loughlin and her husband were sentenced this past week. She got 2 months in the pen, and he is going to spend 5 months in the pen because of their actions with this whole college enrollment scandal. And we just talked about one fraud case, and apparently this one is another one. Though, Mackenzie, my take on this case has consistently been this. This is a yawner. I just simply do not care. I think the worst thing that she did here was she did not engage in bribery of a college university in the appropriate way. She should have done it the way things were done, way it was done in the past. If you want to bribe the college so that your offspring can get admitted, just give the college $500,000 or $1 million. Get your name put on the side of the building, and then bang, your kids are admitted. I mean, come on, Mackenzie. Do you really think that George W. Bush was admitted to Yale based on his SATs? I mean, no, the tried and true, there is a way in which you go about bribing college universities, and she just did it the wrong way. In my mind, that's the worst thing that she did. But do you have a different take?
Well, yeah, kind of. I mean, I feel like if you're going to try to do something that feels like it should be wrong, like not paying your taxes or
right.
paying to get your kid into a school that they can't get into on their own merit. Like, I think it's safe to say that you should at the very least make sure you're doing that wrong thing within the letter of the law. And it's not too okay. much to ask. I mean, if you're well off enough to be able to pay off a school to get your kid in, then you're well off enough to try and figure out how to do it the correct way. And I think right. what bothers me about this case is, you know, there was Felicity Huffman, who right. also served time as part of this scandal. And, like, she admitted what she did right away, was so embarrassed about it, actually, like, indicated that she had a conscience, took accountability, and served her time without question. Whereas right, right. Lori Loughlin and her husband, if that's his real name, like, they still they still don't seem to be taking accountability for what they did. Like, you did something illegal, you did something wrong, you should be the first one to stand up and admit it and say, like, I shouldn't have done this, I fabricated photos of my daughter. I mean, what kind of values is that? I don't even think, you know, paying off a school the right way to get your kid in is demonstrating good values, but certainly paying off a school and fabricating photos of your kids rowing when they've never rowed in their lives, like, it's definitely instilling terrible values in your kids. Like, now, it's morally wrong, too. And just to hear her say, like, well, I didn't know what I was doing was wrong and I thought it was okay, like, it's very frustrating at this point. Like, take accountability for your actions, do your time, and be quiet.
I guess. But I have some personal experience with this. I guess you can call it maybe personal experience. My son is going to K-State, and his freshman year, they asked him to be on the rowing team. Now, you got to understand, my son has never rowed a day in his life. Does he like the water? Does not like to be on flimsy boats? They just needed people to be on the rowing team. So when I first heard this story, and they said, oh, look, they were giving her a scholarship to be on the rowing team, and she never was even a rower. My thought was, well, neither was my son, and they were asking him to be on the team, so that did not seem like a far-fetched. My other takeaway from the story is this. Is this not what college is all about? College is about preparing these young people for how the real world works. And I got to tell you, the rich people getting breaks, that is exactly how the real world works. And so why not just start them off? Hey, that is great education there at USC. I applaud you guys for educating these kids on how things actually work in real life. Well, maybe my final takeaway from the story is, since Aunt Becky, Lori Loughlin, is known for her Hallmark specials, maybe there might be a future Hallmark special entitled Christmas at Alcatraz. I have no idea if that's in the works, but it should be. I would
totally
watch it for sure. Yeah. All right. Any final takes on Aunt Becky?
No, I mean, I see your point about that's what college is about. And I do agree that kids need to learn how the world works, and it's a tough lesson sooner or later. But, if a court allowed this to slide, then, what kind of precedent would that be setting for? I mean, I might as well just get on a football helmet right now and say, like, I'm going to be your next quarterback, give me full scholarship. Like, what kind of conduct is that incentivizing? So I think it had to be sanctioned in some way.
Now, you can mess with the rowing team. Do not mess with our football team. Now you've gone way off bounds. You've taken this way too far in a direction we never intended for this conversation to go. Well, thank you so much, Mackenzie, for joining us again this week. Let's just do a little bit of a look-see to next week, because this week is the Republican National Convention. Last week, we had the Democratic National Convention. I assume you paid close attention to that. Between watching the paint dry on the walls, I also paid a little bit of attention to what was going on. So it'd be kind of nice from a lawyer's perspective to break down the two conventions next week. Are you game for that?
Yeah, I mean, I might need to have a stiff drink while we're talking about this. It's just that the whole thing makes me want to cry as a Democrat. So, yeah, I think we have a lot to talk about. And, although it hurts my soul, like, I am definitely game to dissect the two conventions and predict where the next couple months are going to go.
All right. You know what? I'll be the therapist next week for you. You did such a good job for me last week. But nonetheless, I'm sure there'll be a lot other legal things going on, because it seemed like every week there's a lot going on in the world of law and legal matters. And so thank you so much. And we'll stay tuned. We'll be back next week to further debrief the law.
Sounds good. Talk to you soon.
This week's guest is a good friend of mine, Stephen Iverson. Stephen is a public speaker, pastor, author. Stephen, you have done it all. Thank you so much for joining us this week.
Well, thank you for the invitation, but I'm not sure about the done it all part. However, I am trying.
Well, after the listeners hear what you have to say, I think they will conclude, yes, you have done it all. Because if a person has witnessed a porcupine race, I don't know what else there is to accomplish in life. I have never even seen a porcupine. You're watching them race. And so we're going to get there. But before we get there, how are things for you, Stephen? I know this is during a time of pandemic, and you are a public speaker, and your expertise is disruption. So I'm having to think your business is booming. Well, talk a little bit about how is life treating you during this pandemic.
Well, I can tell you that 2020 started out to be on track to be probably the very best year ever in my business.
Really?
Yeah. And I was in Seattle, Washington, speaking for a government agency up there the week that Seattle decided to go into a shelter-in-place mode.
Right.
And so when I flew out of Seattle, there were very few people in the airport. And I landed back home, and all of a sudden, everything was disrupted.
And, to say the least.
But what's fascinating, a lot of friends of mine who are in the same industry just saw everything unplug and plummet. But for some reason, I think the dynamics of what I talk about and what my clients are needing, we were able to shift and do a lot of things virtually very quickly. A number of them postponed their events, and so we're kind of staying on track. I'm still hoping that the year will be the best year ever, but it's to be determined.
Now, Steve, we're going to cover a little bit about what you are doing now with the whole Porcupine Principle. And in addition, you and I have collaborated on a class together, a lawyer and a pastor, public speaker. And we talk about being unplugged from all the distractions so that you can really excel in life. I also want to talk about that here during today's interview. But first, I want to just focus on the irony of 2020. Now, clearly, you are a public speaker. I am a public speaker. We had to have been looking at this year and salivating over the cliche statement of, oh, we're going to have a perfect vision. This is going to be the great year for seeing the future clearly. And then, wow, this hit. What do you have to say about this whole pandemic? I got to tell you, I remember when you actually took that trip to Seattle. Because I follow you on Facebook. You are a very interesting person to follow on Facebook. I love reading your post. And in my mind, I'm thinking, Seattle? He's going to Seattle now during this? You had no fear. What was that experience like?
The experience actually was very positive. We had the very beginning of that, social distancing should be.
Right.
You don't shake hands, maybe a fist bump, maybe not. So I just told the audience, I think the easiest way to greet each other is just to turn to each other and say, don't touch me.
Okay.
And everybody got a pretty good laugh, but they were spread out. And and overall, it was good. I got to spend a couple extra days in Seattle, and what normally would be very crowded places were...
So you had a public venue way back at the beginning of the pandemic.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah. So
the shutdown happened.
And then it shut down. Yeah. And so, what's fascinating is that over a year ago, I was speaking to an audience in Kansas City, and I hope your listeners and I hope you don't hold me accountable for any of the chaos of 2020. But
all right.
Literally a year before, I said to this audience this line. Believe me when I tell you that every business and every individual will be disrupted at some point or another.
Wow.
Now, I'm not a forecaster. I'm not a futurist and certainly not a prophet of any type. But suddenly March, April, and May turned everything upside down. And that, you know, the whole idea of 2020 being the perfect vision. And, of course, every conference and every business I've worked with, they were really, you know, building on the idea of 2020 vision. Suddenly everything's blurry, but I got to thinking about the 2020. According to my eye doctor, 2020 is actually not the best vision. It's just the average. It's
okay. The really? I did not know that.
I didn't either. And I thought, oh, okay, well, maybe we could still have room for improvement here. We'll find out.
Yeah. I don't want to be average. Is 2010 or is 1020, which one is better?
You know, I don't know, but I'm looking forward to 2021.
Hey, who isn't? Especially because I just heard, and I'm sure you've heard this as well, that I was still looking forward to college football. I'm a huge Husker fan, and this recently they canceled the college football season, and I am still in mourning. I know during last week's podcast, I actually had to get therapy during the podcasting session because I was just dejected that my Nebraska Cornhuskers are canceling the season. No college football. I cannot wait until 2021. So I got to tell you, if you predicted this level of disruption, I have to know. What are your stock tips? Do you have any stock tips for me?
No, not really. But you should be watching for a package to arrive at your house in the next couple of days, because I've sent a special order. It's a football that has the word college printed on it and some duct tape, and you can tape that to the top of your television so you could watch a little college football this season.
I'm gonna do it. I am so desperate for sports of any kind. I've been watching NASCAR. I've been watching golf. It doesn't matter. I mean, if it's sport, put it on TV. I got to watch something just to kind of. Obviously, I'm jesting a little bit, because I do believe that during this last 5 to 6 months, however long we've been in this pandemic, there's been a lot of disruption. I mean, that is obviously an understatement to the nth degree. There's been disruption, but it has been an opportunity. I mean, you asked me before this call, while we're just having a little chit-chat session, you know, how is business going? And the reality is, this is all about sowing seeds. So this has been a great opportunity to reinvent oneself as we look forward to this next year. So now you specialize in disruption. So what should we be doing during this time of disruption?
You know, it's a really excellent time to be thinking about where you go next, not where you've been in the past. You know, in 2019, companies were saying that they were anticipating some form of disruption. In fact, about four right. out of five industries were saying, you know, we're looking at being disrupted, but they were looking primarily at maybe technological advances, some of the competition. 75% of them were getting really, really honest with themselves in regards to their infrastructure gaps and things that they needed to go through. And then 2020 hit, and you know, over 75% of the supply chain gets busted. The 89% of manufacturing came to a halt. You know, at one point, the studies I was looking at said 43% of small businesses were closed. And of course, some of them are starting to reemerge. But the ones that are reemerging are the ones that I believe practice one of the principles that I teach, and that is proactive change.
Okay. What do you mean by that?
They're very intentionally looking at what is it that we need to be anticipating instead of reacting to. And I do believe one of the problems that most leaders in industry, in business, solopreneurs as well, what we end up doing is we start staring at the problem when we should be looking at what is the problem created for us, what possibilities are around the corner. Too often, the problems or the disruption is driven by information that no longer is relevant. Strategic disruption, though, is taking a good look at where you've come from, what are your real issues at the moment, and then what opportunities are next. And when we look at that, changing proactively is just simply saying, okay, where do we want to be? And what ideas do we have that can start to move us in that direction? And I know it sounds awfully simplistic, but really, it's hard work, but it is simple. The disruptors prior to the pandemic, the ones that really turned certain industries upside down and became the forerunners, the forefront of global shifting, were the ones that were finding little ways to make adjustments. And the pattern that they would use is that they'd say, okay, what can we make better, and how can we improve it ever so slightly so that it makes the end result for the consumer, the end user, so much easier and less complicated that they would prefer to do business with us than with the other party who's still trying to do it too complicated or it's too antiquated. So that changing proactively is just saying, okay, what one thing could we do, and then testing it and then validating, was it effective? If it wasn't, then you dispose of it and you try another idea. If it's validated and you see even the slightest improvement, then you make that your practice from this point forward, but you don't stop with it. You keep finding ways to tweak it and make it stronger.
I like that. It's about leveraging disruption so that then it becomes a competitive advantage for you. So part of that is when disruption comes in your life, it has your attention. I mean, you know, squeaky wheel gets the grease kind of concept. And if your life is being upended, then something has your attention. You got to solve a problem now that is foremost in your mind. And so it's a challenge to overcome. And right. Are you finding that is I guess businesses are facing that today as the future is definitely uncertain. I know in my own business, I do public speaking. I teach to lawyers. You know, of course we have our goals, but I used to do live classes, live setting. Well, right now, that door has pretty much been shut. I mean, there are no live classes going on right now. I don't even know if I held a live class if anyone would come to it. But that disruption is an opportunity to come up with a new way of delivering the classes. So it's an opportunity.
That's right. Yes. You know, I think the real key is paying attention to a new twist to the challenges, and really the pandemic has forced all of us to really come to terms with this, and that is that your ability is no longer as important as it used to be, but your
what do you mean by
adaptability. Your adaptability.
Okay.
Is
I
what
like that.
Makes the difference. I'll give you an example. Not far from where we live, right after everything shut down, and they were pretty, you know, they were telling us, don't even go outside of your house kind of roll. One of the local restaurants that we really enjoy, they sent out an email and on social media said, hey, this coming weekend, we are going to do a raw meat sale.
Okay.
And you can order these different packages they provided them because they had literally coolers and freezers full of food that was going to go to waste if they didn't do something with
right.
it. And they didn't jack up the prices. They actually made the value incredibly enticing.
Okay.
And in addition, they added just two items for the weekend. The restaurant's closed for the week, but for the weekend, they adapted and they put two different menu items available at good prices. And you could come in, you could pull in and pick up an order and go. On the first week, we decided to do this. This is a good deal, and we need to stock our freezer anyway.
Right.
So when we went, we literally had to wait for 30 minutes while the cars that went out of the parking lot and down the street were
wow.
coming through. And I thought, well, you know what? They're not hurting. They're probably doing
right.
pretty good. 2 weeks later, we decided to go again, but they had improved. They had adapted. And when you arrived, they literally turned their entire parking lot into four different lanes. And when you pulled into the parking lot, an employee met you and
okay.
asked you what your last name was. And depending on your last name, they put you in lane 1, 2, 3, or 4.
Right.
And so the flow just went so much easier. We were barely in line 10 minutes.
Huh.
And every time we went over the course of the next 2-3 months, they had adapted and tweaked their process just enough that it was smoother and faster, and they were able to keep everybody. And so I talked to them for a little bit, and they said every single one of our employees has been viably employed. Nobody's had to be laid off. We've been as busy. Yes, servers haven't been working inside the restaurant, but they've been working outside behind the scenes.
Right.
That impressed me. Now, Joel, literally down the street, 3 blocks, another restaurant, a similar restaurant, their doors have been closed the whole time.
Wow.
That restaurant didn't do anything. They had the same ability, but they didn't adapt
right.
to those circumstances. And I watched that and thought, okay, in Joel's business, in my
right.
business, and others who are listening, there's some things we just can't do anymore. But
yeah.
we still have an ability that if we adapt it in a new way, it keeps us competitive and maybe even helps us win ahead of the competitors.
So there's disruption in our life, in our business. It's and so it has our attention. It's an opportunity to change. And as you said, adapt. Because if you don't adapt, what I'm thinking of here is Blockbuster. I mean, as far as their ability is concerned, they probably have the best movies out there. Great movies, maybe great customer service. I don't know. But they, of course, are in the bankruptcy line. I mean, you know, who's Blockbuster? They did not adapt to the changing times. You probably can come up with 100 examples of businesses that failed to adapt. And so they're out of business.
Well, and you know, there's one last Blockbuster in the world that still exists. It's still open.
Really?
There is. It's in Bend, Oregon. And okay. They just keep it going out of nostalgia, and they get tourists who come to see the last Blockbuster. It's crazy. But you look at Blockbuster and Netflix.
Right.
Netflix disrupted Blockbuster with the ability to get movies delivered in the mail.
Yeah, and I remember that.
And then after a little bit, Netflix realized, you know what? We can't keep this model going because things are changing technologically. And so they adapted, and they simplified it. And I think that's one thing that, if I could say to your listeners, the one thing you can do to be really proactively changing is to look for every piece of your process or part of your life that you can simplify. Because the more simple things become, the quicker you can adapt to the next thing.
Interesting. Simplify. Making it as simple as possible. It's easier to adapt when things are simple. All right. Well, we're talking about disruption. Disruption comes into our lives in whatever shape or form. It is an opportunity to improve on whatever it is you're dealing with. Now, you wrote a book called Porcupine Principles, and I've read that book. And by the way, Stephen, I don't know if I've told you this yet, but it's a really good read. I mean, you know how to tell stories. I it's almost one of these books you can't put down because the stories are just that easy to read. Did you have a lot of fun writing that book?
I did, yeah. In fact, I wrote the book in the classic business format nonfiction book. And I didn't like it. The concepts were all there. I felt there was good information, but it just didn't seem to be the right fit. And my wife said to me, you know, you're more of a storyteller than your first draft here.
Right.
Lends itself to. What would happen if you wrote it as a fiction story, a business fable? And wow, all of a sudden I thought, now I could do that. And the idea of the story just flowed. It was a lot of fun.
Wow. I just got done doing a webinar for a bar association. We did this whole conference for their lawyers. We did, of course, just me and my computer, which is a weird situation. I know you've been there before, but having to give an entertaining speech when it's just me and the computer. Now, yeah, there's a couple hundred people on the other end, but I can't hear them. I have no idea if they're laughing, checking out Facebook, whatever have you. But yeah, that is definitely a totally different environment. But nonetheless, I forget now where I was going with that story. And so nonetheless, do you have any idea where I was headed?
You know, but I can tell you this, that if nobody's laughing with you and you just go with it and you have a good time laughing, they'll start laughing at the hilarity of your own amusement.
Hey, he thought it was funny, so it must be funny. Actually, yes. Thank you for that pause. This is where I was going. I taught a class on storytelling. It was the art of using your legal writing, your pleading, whatever it is, to tell a story because everyone loves a good story. And you're a storyteller. I remember the first time I heard you preach and you were telling a story of a roller coaster experience. Do you remember that sermon?
I do, yes.
What was your point of that sermon?
Yeah, the entire message was titled My Life is a Mess, I Want to Get Off, or something like that.
Yes, right. Oh, man.
Yeah, and the point of that story was that oftentimes we have that sense of curiosity. We want to have the great experience. We reach the heights, and then we discover the lows. And life takes us through the loop-de-loop and the upside down and all that stuff, and we end up right back where we started from unless make better choices.
Isn't it amazing that through the art of storytelling, people can still remember years later? Because I got to tell you, I heard a lot of sermons that year, a ton of sermons. That's the only one I remember. But nonetheless, you use that same principle in the Porcupine Principles book. And now, again, I'm not going to do it justice. I want to hear from you since you obviously are the author of this book. But your cash line here is how to move prickly people to preferred outcomes. And so I'm thinking disruption, that would be a prickly person. If I come into contact with a prickly person, they are disrupting my life. And so how can I handle that situation to a preferred outcome, which I take to mean a positive resolution of your situation? What is the takeaway from? I don't want you to give away the ending of the book, if you will. No spoiler alerts here, but nonetheless, what do you want to tell our listeners about the Porcupine Principles?
You know, in probably the easiest way to convey the idea of the book and the principles that are in the book is that oftentimes we find ourselves in a situation where things are good, but to get to better, right, there's a few things that need to change. And when we start to make those changes or even begin to bring them up, you'll find individuals who it's uncomfortable for them. And I call those folks the reluctant individuals.
Okay.
And it doesn't mean that they're heels in and they're never going to move, but they just need to have persuasion. And the story, as you said, is actually based on the real event of the World Championship Porcupine Races, where your goal is to move a porcupine from the starting line to the goal line.
You say this is actually fiction or nonfiction? Because you got to be making that up.
No. The real race is definitely nonfiction. It happens every year at the 4th of July.
Wow.
And but your problem is porcupines don't run in straight lines. And yet somehow right, you have to persuade them to move with you to the preferred outcome. And just watching those races gave me the ideas that there's some simple techniques in regards to persuasion that
right,
that we could probably learn and adapt to our worlds. And one of those principles is that the best decisions that everyone on a team can come to will always be the result of timely information, meaningful information, and especially clarity of direction. If
okay,
we're not clear about where we're all going, then what we end up doing is running in circles. And
right,
so finding ways to be more thoughtful in our approach, more respectful, and more engaging by bringing people into a process, we can then begin to make motion to the preferred outcome.
Wow, that is so many different astounding principles there. When I'm in my mind, I'm thinking of prickly people, and you want a positive outcome, but they're unpleasant. I mean, you don't want to deal with them. I mean, I don't want to deal with a porcupine. At least in my mind, I'm thinking, put up a shield, I'm going to be stabbed to death. At least that's what I think about porcupines. And so I'm thinking about some people that I've dealt with at work, where I'm afraid of them and I don't want to deal with them. But nonetheless, your book addresses how to handle those very ugly or possibly ugly situations.
Yeah, you know, and I think we can all get prickly at one point when there's misunderstanding or we feel disrespected,
right?
Finding the ability to overcome our fears. You know, a lot of people fear a real porcupine because they've come to believe a myth, and
right,
the myth is that porcupines can shoot their quills, which they can't. They cannot do that. Porcupines do not have a projectile propulsion system in their posterior.
All right.
Okay. But because we believe they do, we try to stay as far away from them as we possibly can.
Oh,
and
absolutely.
I think the same concept happens in relationships. We start to believe certain things about other people or a circumstance, a situation presents itself, and based on past experience and things that we had gone through, then we bring all those thoughts to the moment, and then we find ourselves avoiding or backing away as much as possible until we find out what the truth is. And the truth usually reveals that some of those things just aren't true, and
right,
it would change the way we interact if we knew what that was. That's why I say I think it's really important that we have the best, most meaningful information possible.
Well, Stephen, there are probably listeners to this podcast who are thinking, wow, there are some people at my place of work who need to hear this message because there are some prickly people. Maybe the listener is the prickly person. They want their other coworkers to know how to deal with them. I don't know. But maybe they're thinking this is great for they want to read this book, or maybe they want you to come speak to their office about these principles. How can our audience get in touch with you?
Well, first and foremost, if you want to get a copy of the book fast, go to Amazon.
Okay.
And look up The Porcupine Principles by me, Stephen Iverson, and you can get it a lot faster than I could probably get into your hands right now because of our the pandemic issues.
Right.
It is available also in a digital format.
Okay.
And to get a hold of me directly, just email Stephen, that's spelled S-T-E-V-E-N, at StephenIverson.com. And the last name's a little tricky, so I'll spell it out for you as well. It's I-W-E-R-S-E-N.
All right. We'll also put those in the show notes to this podcast. If people are driving, you can just go to our show notes and find and get that contact information for you. But I think that is a great book. Again, I have read it. It's a very entertaining read. I would love to actually hear you tell those stories in person because I know you to be a master storyteller. That's how they can get hold of it. Well, thank you so much, Stephen, for coming on. Oh, I do want to talk a little bit because you and I have worked on a project together, mindfulness. And the thought was, considering your background and how you your specialty is in mastering the disruption, handling prickly people, That is law. There are a lot of prickly personalities in the world of law, opposing counsel, judges, clients, whoever, they abound. So we collaborated on this thought of using mindfulness techniques in the law. And so, Stephen, I just want to give you a little bit of the floor here to talk about what that concept means to you. Mindfulness.
Well, as you and I have talked with before and worked with groups of attorneys who've come to kind of go through that program with us, mindfulness for years was almost perceived as this taboo, too new agey kind of frou-frou experience.
Right.
But science, which it really intrigued me, started to reveal some insights on how certain disciplines, personal practices of mindfulness, could actually be to our benefit and help us to be more effective, better in relationships, better in performance. And so we started to kind of unpack a little bit of that. And just a few of the little tiny things, such as being able to focus on how you breathe, how you listen to different situations. Literally how you listen in conversations can give you a greater sense of where do I go with that. And so the idea of mindfulness is really just taking the time on a daily basis, even if it's just for a few minutes every day, to just step back and to be quiet and to be thoughtful about even, you know, and it sounds so silly, but it's so effective. Just be thoughtful of your heartbeat and that silence. And, you know, you and I have talked about how there are some attorneys and people in the law who are quite well known who have made this a practice of their entire lives and their profession. And it makes such a great difference for them in regards to how they have clarity and they have greater focus on what the real issues are so they can make better decisions.
See, that was one of the two things that amazed me about this collaborative effort that you and I went through is we started studying mindfulness and who is using it, who is doing it. And yeah, we learned that Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer does this every day in his office for only about 15 minutes in the afternoon. He will take some time out of the day just to collect his thoughts, if you will. I mean, it's a dedicated effort of being still, being quiet. And we also learned that this is not hijacked by any one religious group or thought. In fact, this kind of runs throughout all the various religions and schools of thought. So there's got to be something to this whole idea of, hey, be still and listen.
Yes. And what we've seen is that it's now present in almost every industry. business environment. In fact, really, since you and I started to address it and bring it to your audience, it has become almost a standard now in many different business environments and companies. And there are two or three major conferences, probably not happening because of the pandemic, just in the last couple of years, where leaders of all types have come together to just learn from each other and find out what the new science is to help their employees begin to practice it. Because the end result for them is that they literally begin to see a decrease in absenteeism, conflict in the team environment, and so many other things. It's pretty powerful.
Well, I'm going to wrap a bow on this because we started with the idea of you are the master of disruption. You speak to that issue, how to maximize to your competitive advantage when there is disruption. And I got to tell you, that applies directly to the mindfulness approach, because when you take time out of your day, at least for me, I'm just going to talk from my own personal standpoint, right? Because we're all unique. We all approach this in our own unique way. But when I take time out of my schedule just to be silent, I got to tell you, here's what happens. All different ideas pop up in my brain about how I can tackle and approach this disruption, creative ideas. And when I'm just in the busyness of my life, I'm not creative. I'm just doing the same thing that I have always done. But this mindfulness approach, this being still, allows for the mind to be activated and consider so many different possibilities. So I think everything you do is kind of connected to one another. I guess, Stephen, you are a well put together guy.
we'll find out how that rolls out when my wife and my dog listen to this podcast.
Hey, you know what? We can always delete out the bad stuff. I have the power of the delete button. Actually, Sean Nguyen has the true power of the delete button. If he doesn't like what I say, he'll just delete the whole thing out. But nonetheless, thank you so much, Stephen, for joining us today. And good luck in your next porcupine race. If you ever are looking for a sponsor for your porcupine, if you ever want to enter the race, hey, put Comedian of Law right there as a sponsor. We would love to have our own corporate porcupine.
Well, if that's the case, I think maybe you should be my partner and we'll just try the race together.
Hey, that actually kind of, we would have a videotape running. If we're going to do that, you better believe we're catching that on videotape. So thank you so much, Stephen, and we'll talk to you later.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to today's podcast. If you enjoyed this podcast, please give us a 5-star review. We need your love to help us continue highlighting the funnier side of the law. I want to give a special shout out to our Vice President of Operations, Wendy Oster, without whom this entire operation would be a complete and utter mess. Our marketing team of Redbird Solutions and Leanne Holmberg for spreading the good word about us. Sean Nguyen and 15.5 Features for making me sound way better than I actually do. And Ryan Kuhn and Paul Kuhn of Triplicity Marketing for our technical and computer support.